Okay. So I was asked to sort of give a 15 to 20 minute introduction, I guess, to my work and my interests, and I thought I would organize that in the following way. First of all, we all have our personal focus, and I certainly have mine, and then we tend to have a professional focus, which builds on what we are personally passionate about, and we go out and have great conversations with people like the ones I'm having here, or work with students, and hopefully extend our personal interests, but also learn new stuff. And then many of us have a public passion, which everything sort of pushes toward, but often we never achieve, or cannot easily be achieved, because there's so much else to do along the way. So I'd like to talk about my work in that framework, sort of starting with or focusing on the idea of video-based observational memory narrative, because actually my whole passion is around video and making the world more audio-visual as opposed to more text-oriented. So there's lots that goes on in the internet, lots of copyright law even that gets written, but that's not that sort of surrounding and certainly within the professional and public concern. But the first thing I like to say about myself is I love to hold a camera, and I love to explore the world through images and sound. And I think I started because my father was a text-based journalist, feeling that a lot of times in text we make people get very quickly to an abstraction, and for many people that abstraction is hard to agree with or even understand, because the data that allowed that abstraction to happen is set out in a very high level knowledge structure. And when you go out and you try to look at, let's say, an event unfolding or a city changing or a child developing and learning, and you're actually capturing that on film and audio, you start to develop a different kind of understanding that's maybe very difficult to put into text, even though we have to put it into text because publish or perish and lots of other things. but anyway, so I've worked for many years on at this personal level. And I thought that some of the things that video does very well is it does portraits very well. Now, portraits are different from who the person is. They're a representation of a person. It can do process fairly well, certain kinds of process. And I filmed a city, New Orleans, over a three-year period, before, during, and after the World's Fair. And so currently my nightmares are all about New Orleans, but that's a different story. The goal of that work was really to allow others to actually try to understand how a city changes based on what people do and how they interact and what they say and what they design and what the law process is around what they can design and can put in. And we put, in 1986, we put 3 hours of video on video discs, on video discs, six sides of a video disc, and there was a course taught at MIT for 2 years where students were able to access that material on disc, which also had a lot of text associated with it. We had asked, there were 50 major characters, six major stories. We had asked all the characters to write their own bios, so you got to see how they wanted to present themselves. And there was a lot of the law, which was a lot of it Napoleonic code, that framed how people could develop the city and what sort of agencies were engaged in the city. So they could look at a lot of the text material as well, and then students actually the first year were able to go back and interview the subjects of the film and see how the city had changed between when we last filmed and the new film. And so that got me sort of into the idea of hypertext before hypertext, It also required me to build a random access editing system so that students could cut pieces of film out and put them together and paste them into their paper. And a story I love to tell is in the final projects, the students wrote a paper, and I asked the person who was teaching the course, Dennis Frenchman, I said, well, what did you think of the papers? And he said, oh, they were okay. And I said, what do you mean okay? How could they possibly be just okay? And I said, and then somehow in my mind I went, where did you read them? And he said, oh, I printed them out and took them home and read them on paper. And I went, oh, so you didn't see any video that was part of the papers. So I had developed a vision where I was very unexplicit about the vision, which was a vision that we could make things that had visuals and sound and text and combine them. And you just use what's best in order to explain something and give evidence of what your argument is. And of course,
that's hard to grade.
Anyway, he came in. He was very patient. He came in and read them online. And the other thing about that particular project, which really kicked off a lot of what my future research was it was 3 hours. It was about 250 scenes, 50 major characters, as I said, and the question was, when you, as a student, start looking at that, where do you start, and where do you go next? The whole point of making that film was to make a very rich tapestry of what urban life was like, and there were, of course, different sides to every argument. There were citizens who didn't want any change to happen, and there were developers who wanted big change to happen, and we're going to get that change to happen. And if you look deeply in the material, you'd see somebody who was making a decision about the development had previously, let's say a person who was on the developer's team had previously been on a city council team, and so people moved around. They got bought. We tried to follow money. We got one scene that sort of was about money. It was very difficult. Most of the deals were done in bathrooms, I'm convinced. Anyway, most recently I've been making a large diary. It was a 12-year diary after my father died of my extended family, which is 7 siblings, 2 of whom have mental illness, and the rest of them don't. And one of the questions that became was, how do kids learn? And that, of course, translated to a lot of my professional work with Seymour Papert, where he was bringing technology into schools and asking, do kids learn better with this technology? So I was also we're moving over to the professional now. I was sort of in the position of advising students about how to use a camera and what they might or might not find in data that they got from cameras. And again, the big problem was, how do you annotate it? It's not text. And it's not so easy to annotate text either, by the way. People really have complex thoughts, and it's not so easy to even go in with a concept net, let's say, and try to get at what they're thinking about. But with video, it's very hard because there are a lot of channels of data that you're seeing and hearing, and there are a lot of nuance, and you can't possibly explain that. So I'm capturing this sort of, I'm using this memory tool we've created, and I'm trying to use the computer in a way to help you get at the story, not that you want, because you don't know what you want, but a story that's interesting or challenging based on what you know when you come to it. And so today, rather than describe video as an artifact, a movie, I describe video and media of all kinds as collections. And I deal sometimes with very large collections, but they tend to be semi-coherent collections. That is, that they tend to be on a particular topic. Maybe created by one person, but increasingly created by many people. And the question continues to be, how do we annotate those, and how do we get you as the viewer or receiver to the next most interesting segment that will help build in your mind a picture of what's happening? And so Now, let me just, I'm going to very briefly go on the professional side, because the professional side, of course, involves teaching. It involves advising students who are master's candidates or PhD students, to a certain extent undergraduates, but largely at the Media Lab, we are in a very fortunate position of having an interdisciplinary faculty, and we pick our own students to work with. And then having conversations, as I said, like this, or as a current conversation I'm having in a new school system where they want to use video very extensively. And by the way, many of you maybe know Eric Salzman. Okay, so Eric, many years ago, right before I did the New Orleans film, or when I was doing the New Orleans film, I actually, he went into the first courtroom where he filmed from many angles with many cameras, with many microphones that were sometimes turned on when he thought they were turned off. A very large case study of what happens in the legal system. And I made an example of what it might be to interactively navigate that, if that was considered a collection, in a way that would give you different kinds of evidence. And so that can happen, you know, in many different situations. But right now I'm in a discussion with a school that's just starting up in Cambridge that wants to extensively document everything that happens in the school, both for PR and for history, and for a big problem schools have today, which is how do you evaluate student progress? And is there a new metric by which we can do that? I'll turn to that maybe a little later, or maybe we'll want to talk about that. But it's an interesting project because for the first time, maybe we're able to have many people hold cameras and contribute to this database and sort of understand at least a little bit how we might annotate and what we might get out of that. Early in my sort of professional career, in addition to making this editing system, we made something called Elastic Charles, which was about the Charles River and some of the land issues around it. It was the first large-scale interactive collection that went into many corporations, 100 corporations to be exact. Every corporation had to put up $5,000 to get the gear to play with the piece, and mostly they wanted it to introduce the subject of interactivity into the corporations. It wasn't because they wanted to fix the Charles River. But
they should have wanted to.
I also, there's a portrait of Jerry Wiesner that's currently on the internet. I can give you the address if you're interested, but it's pretty interesting the way in which the mechanism that we use to keep coherence for you as a viewer when you come into this large collection. It's called a spreading activation network, and what it does is each of the segments are keyworded, and then as you go into the collection, it holds the keywords that you're watching get more and more heavily weighted, so that you sort of have a continuity of thought, because the next piece that's being pulled out relates to something you've already seen, which is a really important step to take continuity away from Hollywood, which means the character is in the right position to get to that close-up shot, and think of continuity as a sort of cognitive construct in these large collections. And a particular mechanism we use there is still, I think, one of the best that we've designed, although we're working on some new ones now. And we can talk about that a little bit more later. But as I got, I had some master's students about 4 years ago when I turned them all into PhD students, and they said, we don't really want to be called interactive cinema anymore. We're not doing that. We're working on the web. We're blah, blah, blah. So we went through the exercise of trying to understand what a new term might be used to call our group, our research group, and we came up with the idea of media fabric. Idea that media is all around us. We take some personally, there's some that is available to us, and what we want is to be able to have a path through that media that is a storied path that resonates with our storied selves. So I even think Google has a very long ways to go in the search domain. I know it's fabulous what you can do in search now, but what you can't do is really a storied search, a search that presents to you in a way that builds story in your head. And I'm working on things like improvisational interaction with media. We also have a large project called Confectionary, which is taking, allowing you to use, the idea there is, can we get media use to everybody, this sort of visual, audio, text use, and it's using a graphic frame, allowing you to put little movies in, and the idea is that you can create very little segments of your life, and then other people can go through, or you can go through and link those through at certain paths, and those pathways will stay resonant for a while before they decay or maybe move into somebody else's path. And the big project we're working on with that is with the Armenian community, to be able to talk about sort of what are, to a certain extent, difficult stories of their lives, and allow the community to come together as a whole, making a new kind of people's history. But this is our hope, okay? This is like, we're pushing the professional now out far, and I'm getting very close to what I would consider my public idea of what media could become. And that is that rather than having single people who act as historians, the society itself acts as the historian builder, and as they go into the collection, they start to make those historical, those pathways that give you historical perspective and commentary. And of course that's happening a little bit in blogs today, but what is not on blogs really is the whole audio-visual medium. So you have many, many people who have still cameras or they have movie cameras, but their voice is very constrained in the way that they build a story on the internet today. And my suspicion is in 5 years it won't be so constrained. Now we still have the issue of access, which is who has gear that allows them to make a story to begin with, and I'm going to sort of skip over that for the moment because there are a lot of issues. I have done some work with in journalism for young kids and particularly kids at risk in Thailand. In particular, I did a big program where to try to get the kids to really use the camera to explore something that they couldn't otherwise talk about. In this particular case, it was AIDS. And that was a very blog-like endeavor where they collectively built a story by first thinking about their village and who they knew. They didn't know anybody in their villages, by the way, who had AIDS. It was quite interesting. And then going into an AIDS village and having them really talking to their community about what they learned from that experience. So I do things like that with small communities, and I think journalism is a wonderful term to use in order to build people's sense of what they could do with cameras and their own voice. You know, my vision, if we get to the very public part, is to have this notion of open access, which I think the internet has done a fabulous job at, but there's clearly a ways to go. There are a lot of issues that have to do with language and also cultural translation. There are a lot of issues that have to do with this problem of the story itself, and how what is on the internet translates to people's life.
When you say open access, you don't mean the narrow sense of everybody should have Wi-Fi. You mean something broader than?
I mean that there are people, that there's a have and have not situation now. And you know, the more that I push for movies and pictures to be part of the internet, the more stuff I'm putting into that pipeline that you might not be able to get access to. And we do a lot of work as a lab. We do a lot of work in Brazil, in Chile, in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Somalia. There are a lot of people in our lab who are out there pushing at those edges and trying to trying to really understand what happens when a culture can build its own understanding of this technology. And we go into some pretty remote places. So I'm also very interested in the stories that are very hard to tell. So what do you do with victims of rape, for instance? How do you make the media really accessible in a way that they can start to build out their story for maybe a very small number, maybe just one friend or confidant, and then not give everybody access right away? How do you stage that out? And how do you get people to really understand what they would like from these issues of privacy? I mean, we call them, we have an umbrella which says privacy, but actually it's how are you comfortable having a relationship with somebody else? And when you can't see that somebody else and you don't know that the somebody else is 10 other people, what impact does that have on how you act as a citizen, if you want, of the world? So those are a lot of the issues that we're working on now and that I spend time thinking about with other people when they come into the lab and want to sort of take some of the technologies we have and take them the next step. And I guess what I'll just say, I think that's probably enough to open a discussion. I do have a little flyer that's on the specific work of projects in my group right now, and you can take that with you when you leave. And for those of you who are very interested in Niels Bohr, I have a DVD of that, and I think in 2 months we'll have a DVD of New Orleans.
That's good. Karen, thank you. Professor Fisher.
So this is, a fascinating cluster of initiatives. I'm especially intrigued by the dimension or direction of the work you described. It seems pressed toward distributed collaborative databases of material images. So as you describe your own intriguing work on New Orleans, it seems only not distributed, centralized, and partially collaborative insofar as you describe, you invited many people to write their own biographies, or it's all artists who write their own biographies. So you think of this as a step toward a distributed collaborative environment. Another example outside the set that you've mentioned, but or within the zone that we're thinking about here, would be Wikipedia, the wonders
Absolutely.
Of Wikipedia, which is highly collaborative, fully
right.
collaborative, but not distributed. And the result is it's a centralized repository. One of the benefits slash handicaps of it is that there has to be then a single canonical version of any given entry. It's a complex process of struggle over what's a canonical version, but there's one. But as you described, many of your projects, if you look around at related things going on in space, there's many opportunities for moving more fully in the collaborative direction and in the distributed direction, which are related but not the same thing. So distributed, the databases as they expand don't have to be held in the same place. You can imagine them scattered about a lot and linked through various tools.
And even Wikipedia, by the way, is not held in one place. It's just not accessible by many people at the many places where it's mirrored.
And is perceived, is experienced
as
centralized.
But actually, in fact, it's in many places.
And in that respect, resembles Napster, actually, its original architecture, which is also, as it's matured, mm-hmm. subdivided in practice, but experienced by the users, felt to be a common node. But it seems to me one of the things most intriguing about this direction is about the direction that's implicit in your work or
mm-hmm.
all the related
yeah.
things is moving farther and farther along here. So we might imagine returning to New Orleans now in its catastrophic state and inviting many more people to document, contribute to the recording of what's happening now and store their material in a variety of places. And then what? Well, then it opens up the possibility of visitors to users of these materials to construct a variety of paths through it, different from Wikipedia in that there would be the telling of the story, but it would be multiple stories, multiple overlapping stories that would gain currency in environments through their popularity, perhaps. It depends on how the search function is set up.
That's what we're actually doing in the Armenian site, by the way. It's many, many people contributing their history, and there will be many people traversing that history and making the path.
Great. Okay. This is consistent with what seems to be the most important part of the site. So here's just one of the questions that these directions seem to suggest. So on the one hand, to have wonderful opportunities embedded in it of engagement with creative energies of a wider set of people and a more democratic construction of the narrative. On the other hand, it has no problems associated with the micro version of the Heisenberg principle, in which people are constructing different experiences for themselves as they simultaneously or anticipate a recording and contribution to a collective enterprise of this sort. It's changing the character of the experience you live by recruiting people into the process of recording it. It's a little more worrisome as a way of merging the construction recording enterprise with history telling. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts about what, so the general question of which these are examples is, your thoughts about the impact of what you were doing on the social and psychological character of the participants.
Let me put it out a different way. Had such a process been available to the United States in, let's say, 1717, moving forward, would we have wound up with, how would slavery have been looked at in this country? Let's say let's push that process back and say, now you could say, well, there would be people who would have had access to it and people who wouldn't have had access to it, which is what actually happened, you know, that was hard to write in history if you were a slave. I think there are a lot of questions about why people don't participate in the democratic process that we have underway, which right now is go to the polls and vote on a given day, listen to what the press has told you, and then go to the polls and vote on a given day. Why doesn't that work? You don't have any vested interest if you think somebody's going to get in anyway in going through that process. So what I think that this does is that it creates it interjects a dialogue into the life of everybody, and everybody makes a choice, and many people will choose to not participate, you know, just as they don't participate now. But probably many more people will choose to participate, and I imagine if this were happening in New Orleans right now, judging from a glance into some of the blogs that are being made and maintained, you would have a very, very different impression 3 years from now who and what were actually responsible for what and why did something come to be, because there would be more transparency. So I think history is, people do spend a lot of time doing research, and that research is good, and so you might say, well, you're going to have less good research, but if you look at Wikipedia, what you have is people are very considered in how they engage in the process, because they also know that there's a social metric that they're trying to meet in some sense. They're trying to be accepted by other people.
Do you want another crack at it?
Well, I was going to say, so do you envision then this increased, you compared this increased participation to a current, you know, polling system, voting system. Do you see this increased participation leading to something like a dialectic, where we eventually have sort of one refined, you know, where in 5 years these, you know, collected blogs and video, whatever, of New Orleans. Do you envision that leading to something like a definitive history of the catastrophe, or do you envision instead a sort of a, you know, a multitude of different histories of the...
I guess I think both. I think the nature of history, what we understand as history, changes what we... So history is two things, right? History is passage through a human passage through time, very abstract. None of us know anything. You know, it's not even a bucket. It's just, and then it's people's opinion, really, or people's analysis and opinion of what took place. Just as we used to talk about how can we describe the camera. The process of making a film, and we say, what took place in the presence of the camera when the camera was turned on? Because that's what you got in the end when you're using a movie camera. When you're using written and visual, when you're using complex media, you have more. You have opinion, you have, you know, probably visuals, what could be observed, and then you probably have people who go back and say, and link something that happened with something in the past. You have people who have their own lifetimes to remember. You have people who are researching longer periods of time. But the notion of history as a perspective taking happens to me in the pathways through this kind of database, so that yes, there could be many, in that sense, there could be multiple histories depending on what pathways took on greatest currency. And one issue that you get into is attribution. So whose history is it? You know, if it's multiple people moving through this collection and there's some dominant pathways, can you say that that's your history? Your history. How do we say
David Weinberger's history?
I have just a question about the annotation, whether that's being done by the creators and assemblers of the content, or whether it's also being done by the viewers of it. And if the latter, then doesn't that then further exacerbate either the problem, or depending on what you think of it, either the problem you're pointing to and you're pointing at as well. I just hesitate to call it a problem.
There's no single solution to the annotation problem yet. That's the first thing I want to say. In the Jerome Wiesner piece, we used keywords, we used who, what, when, where. What also stood sort of for why is very difficult to describe in any way the computer understands. We used, as I said, a spreading activation network as a mechanism through that. That was a pretty straightforward type of annotation that was annotated by the people who made the segments in several works that we did here. It was later re-annotated by the programmer who didn't like certain things. In certain cases, things like if you said street and avenue, the system didn't have a network like a WordNet to look that up, so the programmer just said, you know, we're making this all street.
That's creating a Y2 street problem.
But in the more recent work, we imagine that it's both, and we have some examples of both, and we actually do use, we have a big project at MIT that I forgot to talk about at the Media Lab called the Common Sense Project, which is to try to put into a machine mechanism of some sort common sense, trying to make the computer smart. And so if you take the presumption that the problem with the computer is it doesn't even know what a five-year-old knows, try to build a five-year-old's knowledge. This is being done by the public at large. There are then various algorithms that are run on that to clean up what the public put in, but it's made by many, many, many people contributing. We have a sort of a semantic network is one thing.
Then we have something we're calling LifeNet, which is sort of everyday sensibility of what you do in your life through time. And then we have something that my group is very involved in called StoryNet. Story is not necessarily a sequence script of what you do in your life. A story is very often a set of contradictory or elements that are in conflict, or so it very often has more than one thread going through it. And so trying to develop a database of what could be little story pieces, and the idea then is that the system would try to pull through those and say, okay, what we see so far is like this, and so let's move it in that direction.
I have a question on that general theme, which is sort of variant, I think, of Terry's first question, but it strikes me that in a lot of the projects that we see, or efforts that we see that are cool, there's a changing nature of what it means to be an author and what it means to be an editor, and often they're relatively merged in this environment, and often they're computer-aided, and often they're human-aided, but that somehow a lot of these sort of ability to create new audio and video and images and text and whatever is creating, I don't know if it's fundamentally changing that role, or but it certainly is changing it somewhat. An example is what Ethan and Rebecca work on, something called Global Voices, where it's at once, they're using a lot of technologies to help pull in voices from all around the world, but there's also a very powerful, important editorial function on top of that. So you talk about story pieces, they're writing stories that are on top of existing other stories and pointing to people. They're pulling in RSS feeds, which have all manner of things, including photographs, and this I might challenge a little bit, there's not a whole lot of audio and video and text, and in addition to text, I think it is sort of really percolating fast right now, at least as we're seeing it. But where Terry was asking about the effect on the participants or the consumer, the persons who are working their way through, I wonder if you have any thoughts on how it's changing the role of authorship / editorship?
Enormously. No question. I think one thing you're seeing, and I did go to your site, which is really an amazing effort. One of the things that I don't really understand very well, this right, is as the machine is able to do more with manipulating certain things, of course you have somebody who's writing, who imagined the code and who wrote the code and so on, but you're still manipulating things on a more, often on a more sort of statistical, a lot of the algorithms are sort of statistical in nature. And so that it changes, in your case, you're getting a much broader sensibility of what's out there, but it also changes how a single individual, again, would make a statement mm-hmm. about that, so.
Yeah, I guess I see lots of tensions in between the, if you could imagine a day pop or a technorati view of the world, which is the computer-generated version of all the different things percolating, or even Flickr on its front page, versus the one that is aided by those technologies but also has a heavier human element every day, which is sort of more global.
Yeah, but I think that human element, it's always going to...
keep making it.
It's always going to be there, and it should be there. I mean, we are humans, and what we respond to are the stories that help us see our lives. I mean, we're not.
We'll let you even. Well, someone else can talk, so you can eat it even. Their lives.
Just sort of building on quickly. Flickr recently introduced something called interestingness, and it's incredibly poorly defined. And you can sort of poke into Flickr. It's very, very hard to get them to explain what's going wrong. But interestingly enough, it's an algorithmic calculation of human factors. Which is to say, it's really hard to look at the bits in a photograph and figure out whether it's going to be interesting or not, because bits are bits. It's pretty easy to look at user behaviors with a photo who comments on it, who views
it. Do flesh tones have anything to do with it?
Flesh tones have nothing to do with it. It's sort of the opposite of some of the algorithms that I've written in the past. But it sort of assumes that. Thanks. I'll go into the lettering because we don't actually like to talk about them. But it sort of assumes that, in fact, sort of unlike, you know, Push's project and a lot of those sort of automated computer learning projects, that stuff, teaching the computer how to tell a story, teaching the computer how to figure out what's interesting, is nigh impossible. But getting tens of thousands of people to tell you what's interesting and then use the computer to sort of resolve those opinions may, in fact, be a more promising direction.
As well.
But on the other hand, my guess is that, for instance, the story that I did on New Orleans is interesting to a very, very few people overall in the world. So it's not a popularity metric, doesn't necessarily, I mean, I know that I'm oversimplifying what, but in some sense it's what's wrong with Amazon to me as well. It's not, I don't get the pop-ups from Amazon that are of interest to me, because the mechanism by which the metric that they're trying to pull out has absolutely no idea of my space, you know, my interest space.
If I understood some of the questions earlier, the kind of act of having the participants participate in reporting can compromise the historical narrative and accuracy and that sort of thing. And certainly being involved in video has a very profound impact on understanding what's going on. As a cognitive psychologist, you know, I think about, well, what's the impact of media on cognition and learning? And the flip of that is that how can that enrich the activity? There was some research in the early 70s that showed that people who saw videos that focused on zooming in, which was a newer thing there, paid much greater attention to detail and so forth in the past than people who didn't. And I'm curious if you've seen sort of the impact in changing the way people think about the process, and even kind of ways to proactively promote that.
Not exactly sure what you're getting at. I think I got stuck with the history part, which I don't agree with. But certainly in terms of having people use cameras, they're much more, you can't tell actually because you don't have a blind study, mm-hmm. but kids get very engaged in talking about what they see. And one of the things that we've used cameras a lot for recently is getting kids who are making things to document as they go along, as opposed to write in a journal, be able to click pictures of what they're doing as they go along. And it turns out that they're much more enthusiastic, it seems, again, no blind study, in writing a final report or making some observations on what they're doing, because they're very comfortable being able to use the visual and the words, whereas if they were only having to use words and rely on their memory, things get harder and murkier. But I don't know whether that's, you know, we don't have any data on that.
Amanda?
Earlier you mentioned Google, and you were talking about a storing search that maintains coherence. And you also said that in 5 years you expect things to be much different than they are now. And I'm just really wondering what your vision is of the search and how search tools are going to accommodate for and support video, and how you think that's going to change the nature of the web as we use it now. Because I'm just trying to see the big picture. So everything that you're working on and how these tools themselves work, how will that be integrated into?
The storied piece, I think, is true even for text, that if you just do a text search on Google, what you get is 24 hits ordered in, or 1,000 hits, whatever it is, ordered in not a very good way to have you understand the general concept and then to get more specific. And, you know, if you have somebody who gets into a medical problem and you try to find some information on the cancer they have on the web, it's very overwhelming, and it's not ordered in a way that gives you a coherent way of sort of understanding how you need to sort of grasping on to the different levels of detail that you need. But in terms of video, I think it's still, you know, I think it's a long, long time, if ever, that a machine is going to be able to look at the bits and to know what the image is of. There are ways that closed caption is being used. There are blogs where you have a text track and you have the video as well, which is one of the things we're using. That is a pretty interesting way. But if you look at Flickr right now, I mean, it's interesting because it was brought up. I don't have any idea what people really get out of Flickr. I know it's an incredibly hot site, but to me, it's
hackles were just raised.
The storied sense is just not there. And if you try to organize your photograph, if you take lots of photographs and just even keep those as your own collection, being able to traverse those in a way that is storied based on something that you want to get at, I think that those issues will begin to really get traction in the next couple of years, because I think a lot of people are looking, I think people looked at pictures very early on and couldn't really grasp what to do with it.
An issue has been joined here around Flickr. I'm happy to have you jump in, Bill, but I figure you're not on Flickr, so I would like to pursue it a little.
The storiedness is inserted by tagging.
This is what?
Tagging. You know, you're talking about a storied search, and this comes back to Ethan's whole point about, you know, the human editor and that being inserted. Why doesn't the Amazon work very well? Because that's a computer program trying to figure out what you're interested in.
I understand.
Rather than a recommendation system based on your peers. Now, if people who you respected had tagged within Amazon, you know, if people who are your peers who tend to like the same things you like had tagged within Amazon, you know, what they recommend, and Amazon had searched that, then it would be much more useful, which is why Flickr is useful, for instance.
Well, let me push on you a second, on peers, on your use of peers. Mm-hmm. Who would you say, how big a circle of peers do you have?
No, I'm not saying it would necessarily be a very big circle. Mm.
I understand you're not, but they're, you know, all of these...
And actually, that's more useful when your community is small. I'm not saying a search of all users on the net.
But that's not what any of these things are doing, because they're statistical algorithms.
Of course, they're not doing that, which is why they're not useful.
Flickr does.
But Flickr, you can select your peers, and then you can subscribe to their tags, which makes it very useful, and it is very stored. Mm.
Yeah, I have done that, and I have to say I don't find it interesting. I have not had an interesting session with Flickr, but I know many people who have.
Maybe come back and we'll try on that. No one's to change the conversation, I'm sure.
But I may also be looking, you know, that may be...
Do you have friends who use Flickr?
Many, many, yeah. Many, many.
People who carry cameras, probably.
I know many. So, and I just find it... Anyway, I talk to the people. We have a lot of dialogue.
I'll shift gears off Flickr and talk about a little more. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about something that intersects with what I and some of the people who are working on, which is how legal and other concepts of ownership might cause problems with your long-term vision. I mean, at the most simple, what we're talking about is a legal structure that's rooted in ways of creating that are completely prior to all of what you're talking about, so that the person who's responsible for fixation, you know, the person who takes the first bit of video, has sort of legal ownership rights over it, unless they sort of choose to actively give those rights up. And I also think that whether it's supported by that legal system or whether it's independent, I think this is something of a normative concept out there among lots of people who are less immersed in this kind of work than most of us are, that's right. that there is some sense in which the person who's responsible for first pushing the button to fix something, you know, should have greater rights over it downstream than others. So I guess I have two questions, one really narrow and nerdy, and one much sort of broader and theoretical. The narrow, nerdy question is, I mean, you run into these kinds of legal problems when you have assembled people's work and then had others essentially transforming it, reassembling it in different ways. That's the narrow, nerdy question. And the broader question is, well, you know, what do you see as the difficulties in changing people's ideas about, you know, you actually referenced this a little bit earlier yourself, sort of authorship or ownership as being a single endeavor that one person in a room by him or herself undertakes, as opposed to the more collaborative, distributive types of things that Terry is talking about?
We are using in the confectionery work Creative Commons license, but that's assuming that what you're doing is new, and that's assuming everybody buys into that framework.
Megan Christo sitting over there spent the summer with the Creative Commons offshoot, Science Commons as well.
Right.
And Creative Commons
I'd love to hear more about it, but I run into the problems that you're talking about every day, but let me take them down a level, which is I'm sitting on a collection, a 12-year collection of kids and adults where the adults didn't have any problem with my filming, but I didn't know that the internet was going to come along. And the kids certainly had no, I stopped filming when any of them didn't want me to, but you know, they had no even notion of what it meant to be recorded on video. So I have the problem of and even in New Orleans, I would say that the rights that we have to what we recorded did not take the internet into account, mm-hmm. and what could happen and the sort of commentary that could happen, because it didn't exist then. So there are individuals who are part of that memory. I know I found the case just an amazing, I forget who the artist was, where the artist sued somebody for sounding like him. Recently, there's a case on that the artist, the
Bette Midler case.
Yeah. I thought it was a guy, but Bette Midler may have also done
it. Or if it's not, but, it could be.
So, so there are all kinds of levels of that. It's not just who pushed the button and who made the photograph. It's who's in the photograph, whose voice is recorded. How much right should anybody have to a collection, certainly something that's made from your imagination, then I can see how maybe, you know, you have an organization and you say, okay, these are the rights that we want protected, but the photographs that are of anybody in the street, how do you deal with that? And I think it's a very serious issue. I think the society is getting more used to having people take their photograph and, you know, wind up with that. So it's complicated. I think the Creative Commons idea is very appropriate to this next generation of media, but it obviously doesn't cover all these issues well.
Maybe also the IP thing before we go there, Carl.
Just talking about kids, I just wanted to ask about a little more about the work you're doing in schools and evaluation and assessment.
Well, I think just generally, a lot of people at the lab are trying to understand how there could be a different kind of assessment than what exists now, because testing is a horrendous thing, and even actually at universities there are different ways in which those types of assessments are interpreted, but so one issue, one idea that this particular school in Cambridge is thinking about is there a way to have a portfolio and a portfolio type of presentation? This is a new charter school. I don't know if you know this. So they're just trying to work out what will be an assessment that's acceptable, and being able to have a video record, a very long-term video record of the students and the interactions in the classes could help them make the case for a strong learning environment, whatever, however they're going to make that case. But so that's one of the reasons why they're interested in starting out having extensive use of video. And there are a lot of discussions about, you know, who has control of the camera? Do you have multiple cameras in a room that are not under individual control, or do you have multiple cameras that are under individual control? And then how do the students, you know, what role do the students get to participate in that? And does that take away from their learning? But it's complicated.
Do you have a hypothesis as to the best outcome of that set of questions?
No, but we're spending a course this term to try to understand a little bit better everything. The annotation piece is also very complicated, because if you have really, really extensive recording of every day in every classroom,
yikes,
getting to any interesting piece of material is...
To what extent does that become surveillance?
Yeah.
I mean, to what extent does that change the learning experience? I mean, there's got to be some kind of a panopticon effect that comes into play when everyone assumes that every moment of every day is
being
recorded.
Yeah, that
would
be awful.
No,
seriously,
I
mean,
I wasn't drawing that conclusion, but I
was. It's being discussed. I mean, it's not clear that they will record every moment of every day. It's under discussion with the students as well.
Having worked in television for years, I know that whenever you bring a camera into the room and people know they're being filmed, it completely changes the dynamic of everything. It changes what happens. It changes what people can and cannot accomplish. And so this is a very interesting question of, you know, if we enter a society where anybody might be filming at any time and it might go up on the web at any time, how does that change?
It's called blocking.
But there's also, there are also many ways to bring a camera in, and television traditionally, and I'm not saying anything about CNN in particular, but in general, they bring it in a very intrusive way because they bring it in.
But even if you have a small camera, or even if you have a camera phone with video function or something, as long as people are aware they're being filmed, it changes.
It does, but I would say it changes it a lot less. And I record about 200 hours a year of many, many, many different things.
You and Charlie Nesson have to talk.
I know Charlie. But you're also, I mean, to come back to Ethan's point, you're also a decent person, right? So you're not going to take kind of strange photos of people and put them on the web in an embarrassing way. Or, you know, you're not going to take a clip of somebody making perhaps a comment about the President of the United States that the, you know, Homeland Security Department might find threatening and, you know, send it to the Department of Homeland Security or something like that, you know, but a lot of this kind of thing could be done by other people. And
I guess one of the issues in this particular school is, or the particular discussions that are going on now, which I think are very interesting, which is the students are being included in the discussion. So it's really a discussion of what kind of community do you want, what role do you want to play in creating an argument during the assessment process later on down the road. Mm-hmm. How do you want your own work assessed? What would be fair? What sort of viewership, you know, how much can you, obviously, the difficulty is you can't, once you've recorded it, you have it, and then somebody can subpoena it. But short of that, you know, there can be different levels of privacy within a system for what is recorded, and it's really a whole discussion.
Yeah, but stuff gets out. I mean, once it's on a server somewhere, somebody could take some of it.
Sure, but I think the point is it's a discussion, and it's an interesting discussion.
Yeah, I think it is a tremendous opportunity, though, for increasing self-reflection, communication skills, you know, the use of video to teach how to speak, all those kinds of things that
impact, in addition to just assessing in a passive way. Mm-hmm. So to have the students be able to see that and then talk about what they did.
I think one of the lessons of the Media Lab actually is to have students presenting their work every day makes them enormously thoughtful about that work, because they've usually had questions that run counter to what they were thinking or push them farther in what they're thinking, and so, yeah.
Most of, you know, my life fits the Microsoft Gordon Bell thing where everything in his life, all experience is recorded 24/7. My understanding from your description of what the projects you were involved in is that they're not essentially like that. They are people who turn on the camera because they're already deciding that this is interesting. Whereas my life bits is an attempt to make life into trivia. This is, you know, somebody has to press the record button and say, no, this is worth capturing. Mm-hmm. With the exception of the school project. Am I understanding that correctly?
Certainly my particular interest is that, because I think you learn by making that decision to turn on the camera. But there are many projects that I'm involved in where people want 8 cameras, or we have one at the Media Lab, which is actually filming a child from the day he's born to try to learn about how he learns about language. You know, there are people who come up to me and they say, oh, we can make a camera that will work like Ricky Leacock does. Isn't that wonderful? It can be in the room and, you know, he can do what he, this was many years ago, he can do what he does best, which is talk to people. And I go, like, that's not why he has a camera, but anyway. At MIT, you can imagine there are people who want to do it all automatically. They want to do it every day throughout the day. And there are people who are much more using the camera for their own self-reflection. And it's different, you know.
Should we take one more question? From the back, go ahead.
I'm trying to think about what you mean by story. You talked about how story sells, finding stories. Mm-hmm. Just to make it concrete, I'm thinking about the New Orleans project. If I understand it correctly, it sounds like a lot of clips that conventionally a documentarian would assemble the sequence, and then you as the film goer would get his choices or her choices. And your project is tending towards a model where the viewer has theoretically assembled all the clips, and the program enables the viewer to choose to gravitate through this collection and find what interests him. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I always suggest that people be very cautious by the suggestion what interests them.
For this reason,
that when you come upon a story that really resonates, usually it's because there's some mapping between who you are and what happens in the story. And we take that leap because that's a way that we learn about ourselves, is to collect, to have a big case, big set of cases about how human beings operate, how environments work, and so on. So the trick is to sort of understand enough about the person coming to the material, but also to have the material more mindful of itself so that you don't get introduced to 50 characters, none of whom you know what they do or care what they do, and that's what the program did this time. You know, that's not particularly helpful. It's not particularly storied, no matter how carefully somebody may have crafted those introductory pieces. 50 characters is a lot of people for you to meet. Now, maybe David Lynch could do that, you know, and do it in a way that made you absolutely glom onto what happened, but probably he wouldn't do it that way. Probably he'd let a couple of the characters develop a little bit and go back and forth. So for me, the issue in New Orleans was, could I make people more interested in how a city changed? Because if you were more interested in how a city, if you had some idea of how a city changed, you might feel more agency in your own space to engage in the process of urban change. So I don't know if that helps you or not, but the sense of story has to do with development in some sense, that something develops that you can grasp onto. It's not just a set of it's not a set of raw data where you don't know how to read it.
Okay, I guess so. Just to kind of what I'm trying to do when I think of story, I think of tension and conflict and the element of suspense. And you're not referring to that. You're referring, I think, if I'm trying to listen accurately, you're referring to creating a collage out of these sequences that tracks my own desire to expand my understanding of my own humanity. And so everybody's desire is coming in and going to be different in their experience of this project.
No.
I'll have to try it.
Yeah. I mean, I think you need both. I mean, one of the things that is interesting to us is conflict. How are conflicts resolved? What causes conflict? How are conflicts resolved? That's something that interests human beings because they're able to think about that. I think it's very difficult to, usually when we come upon even a story that we would classify as interesting, but certainly about great, it changes the way we think about something. So it has to have enough structure to do that, which is why the human element, I think, is always very important. I mean, I don't think that, you know, it's not just any series of things strung together. It's not just, it's a collage with meaning, if you want, but I don't think it's even really a collage. I think it's I think there's a big conflict now when I talk about what I think is happening sort of in the world of the internet and media, and people who define story in the Aristotelian sense of a hero who has certain obstacles, gets into difficulty, and then something occurs and allows that hero to either recover or burn. That's a very simplistic story structure, but it's only one. And we're a lot more, I think we've been exposed to lots of different kinds of stories. And I think our everyday stories, I mean, when you learn to speak as a very young kid, you learn to say, I went out, something happened to me, I came back. That's how you tell people what happened to you today. That's, to me, as much of a story as something that I would read in the newspapers or hear on the radio. Or
Claire, thank you so much for exposing us to your story and for some things we can grasp onto and for some conflicts as well. So thank you so much.
Any of you who want to